From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. At this hour, President Trump is sitting down with Democrats and Republicans from both houses of Congress, trying to reach a deal on deportation protection for young immigrants known as Dreamers. And there's lots of political maneuvering going on because they're trying to reach that immigration deal as a January 19th budget deadline approaches to avoid a government shutdown. Republicans have accused Democrats of holding a budget deal hostage to get what they want on Dreamers, but Democrats want to leverage this moment when Republicans need their votes. NPR congressional reporter Kelsey Snell is here. Hi, Kelsey.
Hi there.
And remind us more about the stakes here. The president also wants funding for the wall with Mexico. Is that the kind of leverage the Democrats are talking about, giving him that vote on spending for one allowing Dreamers to stay?
Democrats are talking about allowing some sort of money to help fund border protection, but not to build a wall. So what they are talking about, the scope of things that Democrats consider to be acceptable border protection and border enforcement, involve things like sensors and drones patrolling the border and making fixes to existing fencing area and potentially some new areas of fencing, but not the construction of a concrete wall like Trump is talking about.
Yeah, and I've heard somebody today say, why are we building a 13th century wall, you know, in this century when we have other technology? Well, last month, Republicans were saying they didn't have to move on DACA because that Obama-era program expires on March 5th. They had time. But lawmakers now have to agree on these government spending levels before, as we said, the January 19th shutdown. And here's House Speaker Paul Ryan this morning.
We want to make sure that DACA, the DACA problem, is solved. But as you've heard me say time and again, this has to be balanced so that we don't have a DACA problem 5-10 years down the road. So while we deal with this DACA issue, which does need to be dealt with, and we agree with that, we want to make sure that we have the right kind of interior and border enforcement so that we don't have another DACA problem down the road.
So, Kelsey, what is it Republicans want when it comes to DACA?
What they are talking about is they want greater enforcement spending. They want to make sure that there are more essentially enforcement troops, people who are employed to make sure that existing immigration laws are upheld.
Yeah.
Democrats are saying that they are okay with some of that, but they don't want to go so far as what Democrats call a deportation force. That is what they refer to as that internal enforcement, the people who go around and round up people for immigration enforcement.
Yeah. Well, historian Julian Zelitzer, writing for CNN.com, says Democrats are in a tough place here. You know, do they really want to advance any of President Trump's agenda, whether it's any kind of wall, anything, even to help the Dreamers, especially with a book out claiming that Trump isn't fit to be president? You know, should they have their eye on the midterms in 2018? Are you hearing from Democrats they feel they're in that tough place, especially because of this news cycle?
Democrats are certainly hearing from parts of their base that they want, you know, that there is an enlivened part of their base that wants them to stand up against anything that involves dealing with the president. But you have to remember that Democrats who are here in Congress are elected to govern, and they view that as an imperative. They view the vote of the people who brought them there as saying that you are being sent to Washington to make sure that the government functions. And a part of that is working with the president, whoever it may be, in the White House. And so that's a motivating factor here. And I think it's also an issue that we're running into, that there's a lot of militarized talk about this, about immigration issues, and people here on the Hill are trying to scale that back and make it more of an enforcement police kind of conversation rather than a military conversation.
Well, meanwhile, there's a bipartisan DACA proposal from Texas Republican Will Hurd and California Democrat Pete Aguilar. It would be a green card and eventual citizenship for qualified Dreamers, but not their parents. And that smart wall technology that you talked about, not a wall itself. But in the half a minute we have, what's your sense that there is going to be a deal?
This is a new entry to the conversation. A deal does seem like it is becoming very difficult. And we have all of these negotiators who've been working over the course of several months on this issue. So it's possible that some parts of that new proposal could be worked in. But again, this is looking difficult, and they may need more time than they've got in front of them right now.
NPR congressional reporter Kelsey Snell, thank you.
Thank you.
Now to a major case going before the Supreme Court tomorrow. It's called Husted versus A. Philip Randolph Institute. And the Husted in this case is Ohio Secretary of State John Husted. The plaintiffs include U.S. Navy veteran Larry Harmon, who was removed from Ohio's voter rolls in 2015. Harmon claims that the state violated the National Voter Registration Act, basically that the state had gone too far in purging his name from the voter rolls simply because Harmon didn't cast a ballot in 2009 and 2010. And by the way, Ohio is one of a number of states that use voter inactivity to purge voter databases. Emily Bazelon is a staff writer at the New York Times Magazine and a fellow at Yale Law School. She joins us now. Hi there, Emily.
Hello, hello.
So first of all, tell us a little bit more about exactly what Harmon is claiming here. He didn't vote for a couple of years and Ohio removed him. How unusual is that?
Well, that is a really good question. In November 2016, there were at least 7,500 people in Ohio who cast provisional ballots after being struck from the voter rolls based on this process that Larry Harmon is complaining about. So here's what he says Ohio should not be doing. If you don't vote in one federal election cycle and then you don't update your registration, the state sends you a letter. Now, say you don't write back, like maybe you miss it, whatever, you don't write back. Then if, at that point, if you don't go to update your registration and you don't vote for four more years, you get struck from the rolls. And so the question is, under the National Voter Registration Act, which is mostly about increasing access to the ballot, whether a state can begin this process of striking someone from the voter rolls based on their failure to vote, as opposed to based on their moving and the state getting a notification that their address has changed.
Okay. And so obviously Harmon believes that it's in violation of the National Voter Registration Act. I mean, what does the act itself say about the process that a state must go through in order to remove a voter from its rolls?
Yeah, so I would say this is not the most clearly drafted law in the entire universe, but there is a provision about it. It's called subsection B, and it talks about the state's process. And one of the things it says is that the state shall not remove the name of any person from the official list of voters by reason of the person's failure to vote. And so the question in this case is, if Ohio starts a process by someone's failure to vote, but then does this other step of sending a letter, whether that is in violation of the statute.
Okay, interesting, because I imagine that is what Ohio Secretary of State John Husted would be arguing, that the state did reach out to Harmon, sent him a letter, and it was up to Harmon to respond, and he failed to do so.
Exactly. Ohio says, look, your registration was canceled by your failure to vote only when coupled with your failure to respond to this letter that we sent you. And then we get into this question about what's the real goal of the law here. If you have a law that mostly, this is the motor voter law that mostly was designed to make it easier for people to register to vote by requiring states to put voter registration materials in places like the DMV, right? And so in the context of that law, should the state be able to start off with someone's failure to vote? There are lots of reasons why people don't vote in one election and also reasons why they might miss a mailing from the state. One of the plaintiffs in this case was in the military, and so he was abroad for several years. That was his reason for not voting.
So I presume that since this has ended up before the U.S. Supreme Court, that that means that the plaintiffs have appealed all the way up to the high court. Is that right?
What's happened in this case is that the plaintiffs won before the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. The Sixth Circuit said that this idea of starting out with the failure to vote is perhaps the plainest possible example of a process that results in removal of a voter from the rolls by reason of his or her failure to vote. So the Sixth Circuit did not buy Ohio's defense, and Ohio is now appealing that ruling to the Supreme Court.
I see. Okay. So then what might we expect? I know it's always dangerous territory to try to predict what the justices are thinking, but given the makeup of the current court, where do you think this case might head?
You know, it is my hope that this is not a case that will actually result in a 5-4 ideological split. That's probably wishful thinking. But this is a case about what's called statutory interpretation. It's just a close reading of these provisions of the law and what they actually say. And there's no real reason that this should be a partisan issue. That said, it is true that limiting the franchise, making it harder to vote, purging voters from the rolls has become a real Republican conservative cause, and Democrats tend to be on the other side arguing for making it easier to vote.
Hmm. Other states beyond Ohio use similar methods as well. So what are the potential broader implications of this case?
Well, Ohio goes pretty far in terms of starting this process out with one failure to vote, one time where you don't cast a ballot. And so the kind of question is, if the Supreme Court approves Ohio's process, will other states, in particular Republican-controlled states and swing states, will they change to this more restrictive process as a way of purging their rolls? And the people who are in favor of that kind of more restrictive process say that they're trying to protect against fraud. They're making sure that the voting rolls are well managed, that they're cleaned up. Everybody agrees that people who move or who die don't belong on the voter rolls anymore. It's this question of, do we put up barriers for people who we don't know have moved and who just seem to be inactive for a time? Or do we give them the benefit of the doubt that they're planning to come back and make it easy for them to just show up at the polls the next time? That's the tension here.
Well, Emily Bazelon is staff writer at the New York Times Magazine and a fellow at Yale Law School. Emily, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Today, we're continuing our look at the impact of the new Republican tax bill on states. The law puts a $10,000 cap on state and local tax deductions to offset cuts to large corporations. Yesterday, we spoke with conservative economist Stephen Moore from the Heritage Foundation. He's long pushed for this cap. He says red states subsidize the higher returns in the blue states, and people in liberal, high-tax states should demand less spending or maybe just rise up and leave.
I do think you are going to see a choice that states are going to have to make. Either they're going to have to lower their taxes to be more competitive, or I do think they're going to face an out-migration of people who say, look, I can pay a 13% tax in New York or California, or I can move to Texas or Florida or New Hampshire or Nevada, states like that that have no income tax, and dramatically reduce my tax burdens.
But Democrats in high-tax states say they actually subsidize the red states, which get far more federal dollars than they pay in taxes because they have fewer programs. And now blue states are thinking of their own laws to get around the Republican plan. Let's get that view from Dean Baker, senior economist at the left-leaning Center for Economic and Policy Research. So, Dean, respond to Stephen Moore. Blue state high taxes and the returns after deductions are subsidized by red state voters, blue state voters could demand lower taxes or move to red states. You say what?
Well, a couple of things. First off, I mean, Steve's welcome to tell people in California, New York, they should move to Mississippi and Alabama, and I suppose some will. But I think the vast majority of people in those states are happy where they are. And, of course, they voted for those taxes, or at least they elected the officials who put those taxes in place. So I think it's reasonable to assume that they're not unhappy about their current tax burden given their level of public services, which for the most part they valued. In terms of this idea of a subsidy, again, there's been any number of analyses that look at the net flow of tax revenue and government spending, and every one I've seen shows that the blue states, states like California, New York, Illinois, are big net contributors. These are relatively well-to-do states. I mean, you look at in California, Silicon Valley, in New York, Wall Street. I'm not necessarily a fan of everything that goes on both places, but nonetheless, they make a lot of money there, and a lot of that ends up in Washington. They don't get a lot back in various services. So if the point is to kick California in the face, kick New York in the face, well, this tax plan does that. But insofar as you disrupt their economies, the whole country will pay a price for that.
Well, I mean, this applies to a lot of the controversial topics now, including insurance. You know, everyone is supposed to pay in so that everybody is bound to everyone else. But putting that aside, talk about some of the changes that blue states are considering. Legalizing and taxing marijuana. Now, we just saw California start that, recreational marijuana. But then we also just saw the Trump administration Justice Department saying they're going to strengthen the federal laws that President Obama had somewhat loosened against marijuana use. That makes it unlikely that banks will get involved in this legal state marijuana industry. Will the IRS?
Well, this is an interesting question. There's a lot of interesting questions here. First off, there are alternatives to the banking system, and these people involved in marijuana trade, that's legal in California and other states, they will use that.
California is suggesting a public bank.
Yeah. So you're not going to keep these people from growing and selling marijuana. So if that's the intention, it's really just self-defeating from the Trump administration standpoint. Now, will the IRS do this? My understanding is that they are supposed to pay taxes. Thinking way back, not that I was alive at the time, but Al Capone, of course, went to jail for not paying federal income taxes. So my understanding is their obligation is to pay those taxes to the federal government, even if they're engaged in activity that the federal government doesn't recognize as legal.
Talk about the move to classify income tax payments as charitable deductions if those income tax payments going away in the states that had them.
Yeah, I'm going to have to say that the logic here is saying, okay, here's someone who owes 200 or we'll make a 20,000 state income taxes, and that wouldn't be deductible under the current law. At least it would be above the cap on what's deductible. But we want to let them deduct it from their taxes. So instead of paying that as state income tax, what we'll do is we'll let them make a contribution to a state education fund, a state health care fund. We'll give them 100% credit. And then as charitable contributions, they could deduct it against their federal income tax. I would question whether that would pass the test in the courts. It just doesn't sound to me like the sort of thing that passes muster as a charitable contribution.
Yeah. What are some of the other ideas?
Well, the one that I'm most fond of and have been writing about is basically substituting a state employer-side payroll tax for the state income tax. So the way this works, let's make everything as simple as possible. Say you have a state income tax of 5%. Well, instead of having the state income tax of 5%, you say, okay, we're going to have a state employer side payroll tax of 5%. If I'm working, let's say I earn $200,000 a year, relatively high income person, and my employer pays 5% on my wages, well, they're going to pay $10,000 on my wages. That's not taxable income for me. The employer, of course, could write that off because they're still subject to the federal income tax. So that's not taxable income for them either.
Would you then make $10,000 less because your employer is paying the taxes for you?
Exactly. That's the next step. So what would happen, what we expect to happen, at least the standard economic story, is that the employer doesn't care whether they're paying the $10,000 to me or the $10,000 to the government, so I'm going to get $190,000 a year instead of $200,000. Now, that leaves me in a wash relative to the state government because I've been paying $10,000 in my wages in state taxes. But the big benefit is when the federal government looks to tax me, they're only looking at an income of $190,000, not an income of $200,000. Workers would actually do well. Now, employers will, of course, complain, but it's a little hard to have too much sympathy for them. They just got a big tax cut.
But they might object because it's a lot more work for them. And Wall Street is definitely going to object to something that New York Governor Andrew Cuomo is suggesting. He's proposing something to close something called the carried interest loophole. Explain what that is, first of all, and then what his idea is.
Well, the carried interest loophole is something that goes back to the 80s, and this is a special provision that's there for people in who run hedge funds, private equity fund, real estate investment trust. Long and short of it is effectively allows the partners in these funds to have their wage income taxed at capital gains rates, which is a much, much lower rate. So currently, with the new tax law, if they were taxed as ordinary wage income, they'd be paying a 37% income tax on it. These are high-income people. Mm. Instead, since it's taxed at the capital gains rate, they'll be paying just 20%. So they're actually being taxed at a lot lower rate on their income than very middle-income people, school teachers, firefighters, who could easily be paying a 22% tax rate. It's very hard to justify this. And really, people across the political spectrum, Donald Trump ran against this during the campaign. They've raised this as being a source of really gross unfairness in the tax code.
Why didn't it get closed in the bill?
Well, it was originally proposed that way by Trump, but these are very powerful people. I remember when I first learned about this, this was probably about 10, 12 years ago, I thought the person who was explaining to me was mistaken. So I looked it up, and in fact, he was right. And then I called a friend of mine, a conservative economist who was in the Bush administration, and I said, well, what is this? And he said, well, these are very powerful people. I said, well, I understand that, but what's the economic rationale? And he said, oh, there isn't one.
Listen, Steve Moore and others are suggesting that states should just, you know, have lower taxes. Why not just blue states lower their taxes? New York's budget is $4 billion in the red. Other high-tax states, Illinois, California, have had financial problems. Why not just have lower taxes?
Well, a couple things. First off, a lot of low-tax states, Kansas had notorious problems. So it's having budget problems isn't something that's just restricted to high-tax states. But the point is people support these taxes. Again, I'm not saying anyone's out there saying, hey, I want to pay high taxes. But they support the services that the taxes buy. They support having a good education system. New York has a good education system. They have a good university system. They do have some public services for the poor, which I think most people in New York thinks a good thing. I mean, no one thinks it's good. I just looked it up, the TANF benefit for a family of three, basically our welfare program. It's a little over $700 a month. That's not high living. But I looked for Louisiana. It's $180 a month. That's not living at all. So you look at the various things that the money goes to, and most people in the state of New York, state of California, the other high-tax states support those programs. Steve Moore may not like them, and that's fine, but he's in a minority in those states.
Do you think, as Steve Moore and the Heritage Foundation have been very transparent about this, do you think people are going to start leaving the blue states for the red states? I mean, that's been the aim of some of the conservative think tanks for a long time.
No, I mean, again, I don't think anything's written in stone with this tax deal. My guess is that New York and California and the other states will find ways to limit the harm that they suffer. Again, I think I'm a big fan of the payroll side, employer side payroll tax, which I think actually could leave them better off at the end of the day than where they were before. Trying to avoid getting too much into the weeds here, but one of the effects of the employer side payroll tax is that, in effect, it means that even people who didn't itemize, middle-income people, people earn $70,000, $80,000, $90,000 a year, those people would, in effect, be writing off their state taxes against their federal taxes. So they would actually end up better off than they had been previously.
Dean Baker, a senior economist at the left-leaning Center for Economic and Policy Research. Dean, thank you.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
I'm Robin Young, co-host with Jeremy Hobson of Here and Now from NPR and WBUR. We cover the day's most essential news with analysis and context so you know the why and the what's next. Plus authors, artists, people making a difference. It's a fast-paced snapshot of the world every day. Listen to Here and Now on NPR One or wherever you listen to podcasts.
We're in the midst of a moderately severe flu season. That's according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And in California, about 70 people have died, more than 10 times the number of deaths compared to this time last year. That's according to the LA Times. Pharmacies there are running out of flu medicines, and emergency rooms are so crowded that some ambulances don't have anywhere to leave patients. Dr. Dave Feldman is chairman and medical director at the emergency department at the Good Samaritan Hospital in San Jose. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first of all, the CDC says moderately severe, but the facts around flu in California right now makes me think that that's kind of lowballing it. Is it moderately severe, or are you seeing something worse there?
Well, I'll defer that definition to the CDC, but I can tell you for our experience in my emergency department and the hospitals in our area, we certainly are seeing record numbers of patients come to our hospital. In fact, in my hospital, my emergency department, we're seeing records of patient volumes set almost every day. So we're certainly seeing a record season for us.
Well, I understand that in order to try and stem the tide, for lack of a better term, that the hospital is taking some steps to prevent the spread of flu, such as no longer allowing visitors under the age of 16. Can you explain why?
Oh, yes. We have a flu season temporary visitor restriction that we put in place depending on the severity and the volume of the winter season every year. And so this year we've put that in place again. And so patients under the age of 16 are restricted from coming to the hospital unless they're seeking care themselves with a parent. That's to protect the child as well as the patients that we have at the hospital, because if they're well and they come to the hospital, they only expose themselves to possibly getting sick.
Mm. Well, here's the obvious and perhaps most important question. Why do you think the flu season is worse than usual right now in California?
Oh, that is a great question. Part of it is there are reports about the flu vaccine not matching up to a certain type of influenza A as well as it has done in the past, although if you refer to the CDC, it's about 40% effective this given year. Other parts of the world, maybe as low as 10%, such as in Australia. But it's a combination of flu becoming more of a global issue with people traveling and more access to different parts of the the planet, as well as just we're just seeing a busy season.
Well, so, but from what I understand, even though perhaps the vaccine may not be as effective as in years past, that people are still encouraged to get vaccinated.
Oh, absolutely. Vaccination is still very important and the best step we can take to prevent flu from not only from you getting the flu, but even if you do get the flu, the severity of the symptoms are much less. So I often will hear from my patients that, you know, I got the flu vaccine. Why am I getting the flu and feeling discouraged? But they still did themselves a tremendous defense for their own health because the intensity of the symptoms and the duration of the symptoms can be much less. So there's still a lot of benefit. And the new vaccine that protects against four different types of influenza, you may get one subtype, but it protects you from getting the other, you know, one of those other four, because patients can get sick with multiple types of influenza. And the ones who are the most sick are the ones who often get two types of flu, not just one. So the vaccine still has tremendous benefit.
Well, Dr. Dave Feldman is chairman and medical director at the emergency department at the Good Samaritan Hospital in San Jose. Dr. Feldman, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Yeah, thank you.
North Korea will be sending a delegation to next month's Winter Olympics in Pyeongchang in South Korea, officials from both countries said, after their first formal meeting in 2 years today. We'll hear about that elsewhere in the show. But what else can we expect when the Olympics begin February 9th? Ticket sales have been slow because of tensions over the North's missile test. Maybe that will change now that the North is going, as is Sports Illustrated's Richard Dimack, who joins us now for a quick preview. Richard, tell us more about Pyeongchang, about 100 miles east of Seoul, which hosted the Summer Olympics 30 years ago. Pyeongchang is in the mountains.
It's both in the mountains and at a coastal site. So as the case with many Winter Olympics, there are really two games. There's the mountain games and the city games. The city games are the indoor venues, ice skating, figure skating, speed skating, that is, hockey, curling. And then the mountains host the ski events and some of the extreme sports like snowboarding and things like that.
And what are some of the new sports that have been added this year? We're, frankly, very excited about mixed doubles curling.
Are you okay? Well, as if curling couldn't get more excited, they've added mixed doubles curling with two players, one man, one woman, on each team. Then there's speed skating mass start, which is a long track speed skating event as opposed to the short track you've seen.
Is that what it sounds like? Everybody just huddles together at the start and the gun goes off and they go?
Pretty much. It's 16 laps around the speed skating oval. There are points awarded throughout the race for sprints that occur during the race itself. The first three athletes who cross the finish line win the medals. It's a bit of a free-for-all.
Yeah.
A bit of a roller derby. Now, it's a little more controlled than that, but it is entertaining, I think, especially when you consider that speed skating is often two athletes on the oval at the same time, and you rarely are they in the same frame at the same time. Mm-hmm. So I think it's going to be wild.
Okay, so we'll look for that. And, of course, big air snowboarding.
Right. Big air snowboarding is the venue in Korea is the highest big air ramp in the world. And it's really just what it sounds like. There's a men's event and a women's event. And they try to get as much air as possible and do various maneuvers and acrobatics on the way down. Some of the same names who compete in some of the other snowboard events compete in this. The Canadians are very strong. The Austrian women are very good, too. You know, they've just added another snowboard event.
Look, talk about some of the controversies. Russia won the most medals in the Sochi Games, but they're out of these games because of the country's government-backed systematic doping scandal. But Russian athletes can attend. They just don't have the Russian flag. They go under a separate flag. It's not a government-sponsored trip. But will they? I mean, what does the country want? Do they want their athletes to go?
There are going to be a lot of Russian athletes there. Mm. Their team is not diminished particularly, which has a lot of people upset. The official delegation has been punished to some extent, right? They're not marching in mm-hmm. under a Russian flag. But Russian athletes are going to participate and they're going to win medals. And no, they will not play the Russian anthem when they stand on the podium. You know, it's a compromise without real consequences, I think.
Oh, okay. And what about the NHL?
So the NHL has decided not to participate this year. They may or may not return for the Beijing Winter Olympics in 4 years.
It had something to do with anger at the International Olympic Committee for not picking up some of the payments?
Well, there are various rationales, but the fact is that NHL owners don't really want empty arenas for a month. They don't want their players risking injury for a month, and they get very little out of that, right? If you ask the players, they would say, of course we want to play. So the only people who really don't want them competing are the NHL owners.
So a player can't go. I mean, a National Hockey League player can't go unless their owners say they can. I mean, so will there be no NHL players there?
That is correct. There will be no players under contract to an NHL team there. So there are former NHL players. There will be players who play in the KHL, the Russian league, who once played in the NHL. They'll be there. Some minor league players who are not under contract to NHL teams, if there are any, I suppose could play. There will be college players there competing for the U.S. and I suppose other countries too. But there will not be NHL players there.
And no Bob Costas, broadcasting for NBC. I don't know what I'm going to do. He's done it for years.
Right. You know, NBC has a deep bench. I think this year everything is available live at NBC in one way or another, either streamed or over the air on whatever of the multiple networks they have. So those who want to watch the games live will be able to do it this year.
Without Bob Costas or Matt Lauer, for that matter, is the thinking that South Korea is ready?
Oh, they're ready. That has been a concern in games past, but it is not a concern of these games. Readiness, venues, you know, housing being ready, that sort of thing that was an issue in Sochi is not a concern this time.
Yeah. Richard Dimack, senior editor at Sports Illustrated. Lucky him. He's going to be going to the Winter Olympics in South Korea. Richard, thanks so much for a preview.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Injuries are a fact of life for Olympic athletes. Think about some of the risks competitive skiers face: fractured bones, busted knees, concussions. Pretty much every member of the U.S. national ski team has had spectacular crashes. Several, including star Lindsey Vonn, are going down to the wire to recover from injuries in time to compete at this Olympics. Tom Bonsi from the Northwest News Network introduces us to a pair of Olympic hopefuls from Oregon who've persevered through potentially career-ending injuries.
9 months ago, alpine ski racer Lauren Ross woke up in a Colorado hospital in excruciating pain. She'd just come out of the operating room after blowing out a knee in a crash at the 2017 U.S. National Championships.
There were many moments like that where I had a hard time thinking about anything but the pain that I was in.
Ross grew up in Central Oregon skiing from the age of two. She learned to race with the Mount Bachelor ski team and has been on the U.S. national team for 8 years. Speaking via Skype, Ross says she's been hurt many times before, but this latest injury was the most severe. The recovery taxed her emotionally as well as physically.
I was battling some demons and some questions that I had, you know, all of the uncertainties about, am I going to be able to ride a bike again? Am I going to be able to walk normally again? I wasn't really thinking too much about skiing at that point.
Ross worked hard to overcome those demons and is back doing well at the top level race circuit. The 29-year-old says it's scary to think about crashing again, but the rewards of skiing are worth the risk.
If I were to retire from skiing and if I were to say, you know, I don't want to take that risk, I'm done, I would still feel the fear and the doubt in myself. And I would also feel regret on top of that. So I just knew that I had to give myself this chance.
Ross got advice and encouragement from her boyfriend, also an alpine ski racer, also from Central Oregon. Tommy Ford suffered a gruesome injury in 2013 that took several years to recover from. He broke his femur in a crash against a tree while free skiing in the French Alps.
I couldn't help but share like how I came back to skiing because I did it at a different pace than a lot of people, and I continue to share it's okay to take your time. It's okay. Go at your own pace because there's a lot of pressure to come back quick, especially during the Olympic year.
Bend, Oregon could be called a cradle for Winter Olympic hopefuls this year. Besides the two alpine skiers, three snowboarders who also honed their skills at nearby Mount Bachelor are gunning for the games. Ford says Bend's location at the base of the Cascade Mountains makes it ideal for grooming future Olympians.
There's rivers and trails all around. It's just a playground, and it's hard not to get out and enjoy the woods or the mountain, the river.
Both Ford and Ross had top 10 finishes at World Cup races in December. Ford has now locked in a berth on the U.S. Olympic team. More good, consistent results in January races in Europe should secure a spot for Ross on the U.S. Olympic team bound for South Korea, too. They join other likely Olympians there, including Michaela Schifrin, Lindsey Vonn, and Ted Ligety.
I'm excited to get to the Olympics and enjoy the moment. The last Olympics, it was very rushed and it was kind of chaotic and pretty stressful, honestly. It was really cool to see a lot of friends and family, but the whole event was really intense and I want to be able to enjoy Korea.
The 28-year-old Ford anticipates specializing in giant slalom in Pyeongchang, which he raced at the 2010 Vancouver Games. Ross says she would ideally like to race in downhill, Super G, and Super Combined in Korea, which are the events she contested at the Sochi Games in 2014. The U.S. Ski and Snowboard Olympic team will be named in late January, shortly before the Winter Games' opening ceremony on February 9th. For Here and Now, I'm Tom Bonsi reporting.
Almost 40% of rural Americans do not have access to broadband internet. That's according to the Federal Communications Commission, and that's compared to 4% of people in cities. Yesterday, President Trump signed two executive orders aimed at addressing that lack of access by making it easier for internet providers to get broadband permits and for wireless operators to install cell towers on federal lands. Here's the president reading part of the orders at the annual convention of the American Farm Bureau Federation in Nashville.
Supporting broadband tower facilities in rural America and federal properties managed by the Department of the Interior. Those towers are going to go up, and you are going to have great, great broadband. Thank you.
Well, here to explain is our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Ed Lee is managing editor at Recode. Hi there, Ed.
Hey.
So, first of all, the orders that the president signed are based on recommendations from a report that was issued by the Task Force on Agriculture, and Rural Prosperity. So, what exactly do these executive orders allow?
So, in this case, the orders are pretty narrow. It effectively says anyone who wants to build a broadband facility or a tower that includes wireless capabilities on federal lands, you know, let's expedite that. Let's make it easier for them to do so because these areas aren't connected. And I think that's a faster way to get through that process. It's largely a red tape issue as far as the order sort of solves. But beyond that, there isn't any provisions for funding or anything like that. And it's not that specific beyond the federal lands.
Okay. So, okay, to that point about red tape, because I'm seeing that some experts say that the biggest obstacle to broadband expansion in these rural areas is not necessarily red tape, but it's a lack of competition. Because businesses don't make enough money on providing broadband access as population density goes down because it's just expensive to wire that last mile to those homes.
Exactly right. I mean, the capital cost, the cost to build the infrastructure around it is so high that you usually do it only if they know there's enough people that they're going to, you know, subscribe to the service that they'll get their money back and then some. It's just too expensive. I think that's the big part of it. But it's not just competition in these sort of rural areas, but even in urban areas. You know, oftentimes you only have one broadband provider, so you're stuck with it. You know, you have a captive customer base if you're a cable or a wireless provider there. And so there isn't as much incentive for you to sort of upgrade your services if you know that, you know, their customers can't get the same service elsewhere.
Mm. But on the other hand, if the amount of red tape that a company would have to go through is reduced by virtue of these executive orders, doesn't that help clear the way at least a little bit? Might that be just enough incentive to get these companies to do the investment required to wire up rural America?
Yeah, I mean, of course, any time you have bureaucracy, that's an unnecessary thing in most cases, and I think that certainly helps. But, you know, you have to wonder the bigger context here. Are they solving a problem for a really narrow swath of Americans? Of course, it's good to sort of build out as much as you possibly can. It's important for the country to get wired as much as possible. But there are, by one estimate, at least 60 million urban Americans who don't have access to broadband, not because the physical infrastructure isn't there, but because they can't afford it.
Okay.
So, you know, that's another – you can look at the problem from the other side as well. And I think that part hasn't been as readily spelled out.
I gotcha. But sticking with this problem of rural broadband access, I mean, just for a second to clarify, broadband, the FCC defines at internet connections at a certain speed, right?
Certain speed, I mean, it's vague. It's ultimately sort of an arbitrary designation. Cable services, cable companies, when they started offering internet speed, they sort of defined that broadband limit, or that minimum rather. Something like 25 megabytes per second is considered generally what's broadband or fast internet access. You know, some phone providers offer something similar to that or just slightly below that, so you could consider that broadband. Once wireless service, I think 5G is what they're talking about now, hits that speed on a regular basis, you can consider wireless service to be broadband as well.
Okay, so to get back to this issue of rural access, to get those folks the broadband internet that they want and need, I mean, how much would it cost? Do we know?
Yeah, so there's all kinds of estimates. The FCC itself, in one paper, cited anywhere as much as from 40 to 80 billion. That's, you know, to build the infrastructure. Even though there's a wireless capability with these towers that they're talking about, you still have to sort of kit it out with actual fiber or some type of cable that goes to these towers. So that's on the low end one estimate. Another estimate by Deloitte from last year said as much as $150 billion over the next 5 to 7 years. So it's costly no matter what.
Okay. So to your earlier point about one of the major problems is that there's basically single service providers in all of these areas. For as long as rural Americans are beholden to the local monopolies of their cable or internet providers, is there a better solution?
Well, so there actually is. I mean, the current FCC chairman, Ajit Pai, this is part of his orders. His predecessor, Tom Wheeler, actually instituted certain provisions in certain cases for what's called an overbuild requirement. So, for example, Time Warner Cable was acquired by Charter recently. And as part of that sort of allowing that to go through, Wheeler said, hey, you need to overbuild in certain markets, meaning create infrastructure so that another competitor come in and offer broadband access to your same customer, you know, to allow this deal to go through. Ajit Pai sort of rescinded that order. So that, you know, that's one way that you could create competition that is no longer a part of the equation now.
Ed Lee, managing editor at Recode. Thanks so much, Ed.
Anytime.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now,